smiling faces.
Some of us need to move over there.
Yeah, I just feel like we're a little weighted. Representative Ringel will hold down.
Far left.
That.
Yes.
You can hold down that end of the table. We're going to begin this morning committee with a bill measure introduction, council.
Chair, members of the committee, the first one is LC 616, modifies procedure for determining county share of granted aid program monies, eliminates requirement that the Oregon Department of Administrative Services issue community corrections caseload forecast.
And we'll just do them in bond.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill LC 2316, at the request of the Fan Oak Creek Grange, creates offense of operating a motor vehicle while under a mobile telephone or portable computer. Defines mobile telephone or portable computer, punishes by maximum fine of $300. A commission offense results in bodily injury or property damages by maximum fine of $600. LC 2843, at the request of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, directs Board of Public Safety Standards and Training to establish four policy committees for specific disciplines governed by board specifies membership. LC 2886 defines advisory committees for medical assistance programs, designates advisory committee appointed to complete research for or make recommendations on administration or policy for medical assistance programs as public body. LC 3295 directs the Chief Justice to create a task force to study admission of person to practice a law in this state without passage of bar examination. If person is admitted to the practice of law in another state allows admission of the Oregon attorney on a like basis. LC 3316 expands crime of interference with public transportation. LC 3452, for the purpose of statutes, defines may not and shall not as the equivalent expressions of absolute prohibition. LC 3434 expands exemptions for licensing and registration requirements for investigators and operatives. LC 3624 increases length of time within which juvenile court must conduct preliminary hearing on Emancipation Act application. LC 3626 increases penalty for crime of riot, punishment by maximum of 10 years imprisonment, $200,000 fine. It changes it from a Class C to a B felony. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, counsel. Just want to remind members of the committee that bill introduction does not necessarily indicate support or opposition to any of these particular pieces of legislation, or that any of them may ever even receive a hearing. I would suggest that several of these bills have wonderful relating clauses, and would remind the committee of the value of that. With that, are there any objections to these bills being introduced as committee bills? Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have an objection. I just have a question from where they come. There's two in particular, LC 2316, relating to driving while using an electronic device.
That one has been requested by the Fan Oak Creek Grange.
Fan Oak Creek Grange. Okay. And then I had one more. The last one, LC 3626, increases penalty for crime of riot.
That bill, I think, has been requested by the chairman.
By the chairman?
Yes.
I think.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments related to these bills? Any objections? Hearing none, bills will be introduced as committee bills. Our next item of business, committee, is we'll open a work session on House Bill 2352. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think we should refer to Andrea Chartel on this because I know absolutely nothing about the bill.
Oh, well, in that case, Ms. Chartel.
Full disclosure. I'll do that today.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2352
as members of the Civil Committee will recall, is, excuse me, from the Oregon Law Commission, and what it does is it reorganizes Oregon civil rights statutes. It clarifies unclear or inconsistent language relating to enforcement procedures. This bill passed unanimously out of the subcommittee with the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments. As members of the civil subcommittee will recall, we originally heard the bill and then came back a week later and heard the bill. We neglected, and I guess I neglected, to have us examine the Dash 1 amendments, which were talked about at the first meeting. I think that it was the intention of everyone that we were going to adopt those in addition to the Dash 2 amendments, so those need to be considered and I would assume adopted by the committee. I believe that it is Mr. Shetterly, Representative Shetterly, who is to carry this to the full committee.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill comes to us as the product of a work group over the last 18 months or so of the Oregon Law Commission, and it constitutes a reorganization of Oregon's civil rights statutes. I want to underscore that this is that the effort of the work group here was not to make, and in fact I think the work group largely succeeded, substantive changes in the statutes, but rather reorganization to make the chapter user-friendly and workable both for citizens, private citizens, for practitioners that work in the area, and also for BOLI. I would point out that the work group was represented, consisted of Jeff Carter, former president of the Oregon Bar Association, who is a member of the Law Commission, David Hendricks from the Office of Legislative Counsel, Marcia Olmiller from BOLI, Bureau of Labor and Industries, Bob Jundeff from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and Sandra Hansberger from Northwestern School of Law. It met several times as a work group, presented its work to the Law Commission, and also held a full public meeting at the Oregon State Bar headquarters. And that meeting was attended by representatives from the Law Center, the State Bar Labor and Employment Law Section, the Civil Rights Section, the Disability Law Section, and members of private firms. When we met in the hearings here, we had good attendance and participation, and again confirming that the Bureau of Labor and Industries, Commissioner Roberts, is on board with this as well as a useful reorganization of the statutes. The mess that Chapter 659 is in terms of its structure was remarked on even in a federal court as being almost incomprehensible in a case that dealt with Chapter 659 in terms of how to make the statutes read together, how to make them work. That underscored, I think, for everybody the need to get in and make this project come together. It did. I think we have a good bill here. I will point out that I think the only change that we made that was that raised any controversy was something raised by the City of Portland, and that dealt, I think, in Section 45 with the whistleblower statutes. And this relates only to public employers. There is a whistleblower statute that says that if a public employee has been if action has been taken by a public employer against a public employee for some whistleblowing activity, there is in current law a 90-day statute of limitations. Part of what House Bill 2352 did in reorganizing the chapter and trying to harmonize all of the various provisions was to arrive at a single one-year statute of limitations for the filing of these claims. This particular whistleblower statute was out of sync with that, and in harmonizing that, we've extended the statute of limitations for these claims by public employee whistleblowers against public employers. That was objected to by the City of Portland, but I think the subcommittee considered that also, sort of the work group, again, and the point being that there was a strong policy in having a uniform system here so that you didn't have different statutes of limitation just depending on who the plaintiff and who the defendant happened to be in the area of the civil rights statutes here. And, of course, a whistleblower claim against a public employee, a public employer is still nevertheless subject to the 180-day tort claim notice that is also applicable generally to claims against public bodies. I think we did intend to adopt the Dash 1 amendment, so if we did not, we should do that today. That just clarifies the application of the 180-day tort claim limit. And so, Mr. Chair, I would first move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2352.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly. Are there questions for Representative Shetterly about the effect of the Dash 1 amendments? Has everybody had a chance to review that amendment? And it's, I want to make sure you feel like you had an opportunity. I know there are people here who could come forward if we had questions about that.
Just, Mr. Chair, looking at the summary again, what that does is it deletes a sentence that could have been interpreted as an expansion of the 180-day notice requirement of the Oregon Tort Claims Act. So we're just restoring, clarifying that we are maintaining current law by the
right.
Dash 1 amendments.
Right. That's my understanding of the amendment as well.
Oh, I have a question.
Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. Were the Dash 2 amendments adopted already?
Yes, they were.
Failed to adopt the Dash 1?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
we had someone pitch hitting that day, I think, in the civil subcommittee chair position who must have just missed that. That was me, Representative Walker.
That was
the joke behind that.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make one other point. If you'll see, and I'm not sure if this got passed out to the full committee or not, but originally there was a fiscal statement that said there was an indeterminate cost. Or a fiscal impact statement that there was an indeterminate cost. In the meantime, in the couple of weeks that we've had, a fiscal has looked at both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments and says that there's no fiscal impact.
That's what we like to hear. Okay. We have Representative Shetterly has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Any discussion about his motion? Any objection? Hearing none, the Dash 1s are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move House Bill 2352 as amended by the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments to the floor of the due-pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2352 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation as amended by the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. Any discussion? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just briefly, Mr. Chair, and perhaps to Representative Shetterly. Under Section 13, Subsection 4, seems to be a new provision under which if Bowley files a claim within the 180-day tort claim notice period, the tort claim notice is satisfied. Is that a new section? Is that a change in existing law? I don't remember that in the old law.
The notice of claim, Section 13, sub 4? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. The notice of claim required under 30.275, that's your tort claim notice against a public body.
And the last sentence.
The requirement of a notice is satisfied if a complaint is filed under Section 2. Complaint is filed under Section 2 within the time period. And referring back to Section 2, the filing of a complaint with Bowley satisfies the notice requirement of the Tort Claims Act. That's how I understand that section to read.
Yeah, I just have a follow-up question on that.
We've got Marshall O'Neill here from Bowley.
I was going to say, why don't we let our experts help us out here, and then if you've got further questions, Representative.
Right. My question sort of evolves from some practical experience in dealing with claims that are filed with Bowley. In other words, a person can come in with a claim to the Bowley office, the claim is against the public body. You won't file a complaint right away, of course. You conduct an investigation. The investigation takes us beyond the 180-day time limit, and nobody has given a tort claim notice. The claimant has not been advised to give a tort claim notice, and the claim is dead. And I'm wondering what responsibility, I don't see that there's a responsibility here in the Act that Boley must file a claim. However, I think it is arguable that if a claimant came into your office and you did an investigation, you may be obligated either to file a notice or tell the claimant to file a notice himself to preserve the claim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman.
Marsha, would you identify
yourself?
I'm
Marsha Oley Miller from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and also participated in the work group for the bill. The Dash 1 amendment actually removed sentence 2 of subsection 4 of section 13. So the sentence that I believe you're looking at, the requirement of a notice of claim under ORS 30.275 satisfied if a complaint is filed under section 2 of this act within the period of time specified by ORS 30.275 sub 2. That was the purpose of the Dash 1 amendment, was to get rid of that sentence. And so Boley will continue its current practice, which is to advise people who are filing against a public body that they need to file a tort claim notice.
Yeah, that's not been my personal experience. How do you give that advice as a practical matter? Is it something written or something that the...
There is a written notice that advises anyone who's filing against a public body that they need to file a tort claim notice. That is their responsibility. The agency cannot do that for them, but they are advised to do that.
Why can't the agency do that?
The agency can't do that because we don't act as counsel to complainants if they go to court. We are there to accept administrative claims, complaints only.
And it's true, then, if someone did not give the tort claim notice, even after having been advised, you would not administratively proceed with the case?
Actually, a tort claim notice is not necessary for a complaint to go through the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Excuse me, that is what we have been advised by the Attorney General, and that's always been the practice, that the tort claim notice does not apply to an administrative complaint. It would, however, apply if they were to leave the agency and take their case to court and hadn't filed a 180-day notice. The court could tell them that they couldn't bring it to court.
Okay. Well, I think my questions are satisfied. I think I still have a problem with the fact that some cases that could even be meritorious will not get filed against public bodies because of the failure to give the tort claims notice. Many claimants believe that's the function of Boley when they go in, and I think they'd be surprised to find out that it wasn't.
Okay, thank you, Representative Ackerman. Are there any other questions while we have Marsha here at the table about this bill? Thank you, Marsha. Representative Shetterly's motion is to move the bill as amended. Is there any other further discussion? Representative Ringo.
I guess I would just like to follow up on Representative Ackerman's line of questioning and ask Representative Shetterly whether there isn't some merit to his point and just what your response to it is.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my response would be I'm not sure. I don't have the same experience. Besides that, though, I think the point of this bill was not to make substantive changes. I think that would be a fairly substantive change to impose on Boley an obligation to file a tort claim notice on behalf of a claimant. So we were going to do that. I think it would be best done in another bill because the purpose of this was to try not to get into making substantive changes so that we could get this procedural stuff done.
Does that satisfy your question, Representative Ringo? Good. Thank you. Any other questions, discussion? Hearing none, will you call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Lowe?
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Carol Walker?
Aye.
Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bowman?
Excused.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2352 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Shetterly, will you carry? And now we're going to jump ahead while we have Ms. Chartel here with us to House Bill 2375 and open a work session. Council?
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. House Bill 2375 addresses a Court of Appeals decision, Graham versus Brooks Maritime, a 1999 Court of Appeals decision. In that case, the Court of Appeals upheld a trial court decision to disallow the use of deposition testimony at trial because the counsel in that case had failed to serve the witness with a trial subpoena at the time of the deposition. The change that this bill would do is intended to make it clear that in and of itself, a party's failure to serve a trial subpoena on a witness at the time of his or her deposition does not constitute sufficient grounds to deny the use of the deposition. What this means is that the court will still have discretion to deny the use of the deposition, but just the fact that the lawyer did not serve the witness with a subpoena at the deposition is in and of itself not a sufficient reason. And the reason for that is that oftentimes lawyers will depose many, many, many witnesses that they may or may not intend to call at trial. Also, at the time that they depose the witnesses, it's sometimes very unclear when the actual trial date is going to be, that kind of thing. This also passed unanimously out of the Civil Subcommittee, and Representative Backlund is to carry it to the full. Also let you know that there is no fiscal or revenue impact on this bill.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I think that Committee Counsel has done an excellent job of prepping us, and she's stolen much of my thunder, but that's okay. To add to what has been said, the Procedure and Practice Committee believes that this measure poses no new constitutional issue. It does not change the application of the Oregon Evidence Code, and that it should have no economic impact, as was stated earlier. And Andrea explained the history of this, the particular court case that brought this out. And so, in my view, this is something that we as a committee should be able to pass out with a certain degree of pleasure. So with that, questions?
Questions for Representative Backlund.
Straightforward.
It was actually relatively good, I thought relatively good testimony in the Civil Subcommittee about the potential door that this would open if we didn't close it in creating a real challenge, I think, for practicing attorneys in this respect. So I think it's a good bill.
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vicki Walker.
I was surprised to hear this because, as you know, I do deposition work, and attorneys do discovery depositions all the time and never know if we're going to trial or when they need them. In fact, they often don't order the transcript until the night before. Because they forgot to do it. So those attorneys get a sharp tongue when they do that and a high bill, but, you know, I think that's a ridiculous omission in the statute. I'm surprised that it's never come up before.
Well, I think this was a case, as I recall, where a particular judge determined that there had been an opportunity to serve this witness who was now unavailable at an earlier point in the case. When that got to the Court of Appeals determined that, in fact, the judge had the ability to exclude the use of the deposition based on the wording of the statute. And I tend to agree with the court's interpretation. I think the statute does give them that right, and that's why this is, a relatively important fix. And I'm confident that none of the attorneys who sit on this committee have ever waited until the eve of trial to request a deposition. Have we, Representative Ackerman, Representative Rindle, Representative Shetterly, Representative Wood? Yeah, they are. They are.
Or the weekend, like a Friday night. I've had that happen too, John.
Okay. We are going to... did you make a motion, Representative Ackerman?
I have not, Mr. Chair, but...
All right, let's have one of those.
I move that we pass House Bill 2375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Backlund moves House Bill 2375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion to his motion? Hearing none, we'll call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Backlund?
Aye.
Lowe?
Aye.
Rindle?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Vicki Walker?
Aye.
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 Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2375 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Backlund to carry.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I might add, Mr. Chair, that I have one other bill to carry, and I kind of stumbled on it. Representative Shetterly bailed me out, so I promise that I'll do much better this time.
Well, we'll be watching. We'll be the judge of that, Representative Backlund.
I'm sure you will.
Thank you, members of the committee. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, too, Ms. Chartel. We'll now go back onto the schedule and open the hearing on House Bill 2355. The work session, I'm sorry. Work session, House Bill 2355.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2355 clarifies that a person who is adjudicated delinquent before a juvenile court can seek post-adjudication relief. The grounds for post-adjudication appeal would be the substantial denial in the proceedings of constitutional rights or the unconstitutionality under the statute under which the juvenile was adjudicated delinquent. The bill, and this was added in the dash one and dash two amendments, adds a two-year statute of limitations that require the person bringing the post-adjudication relief must do so 2 years after their 18th birthday. We have the dash two amendments before you. They were adopted. We had written language, but it was not in LC form at the time, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so you would probably need to adopt these amendments separately before you move on to the bill. The bill has no fiscal impact, and Representative Shetterly is the carrier of the bill, and I will defer to him.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see Michael Livingston is in the room today, too. I think he was the spokesperson for the work group on this bill. It's another bill from the Oregon Law Commission, part of the juvenile law reform effort that the commission has undertaken. We've got other bills pending and some that have passed out, I think, on that. This clarifies the procedure, clarifies the statute, I guess, regarding post-adjudication relief in juvenile proceedings. It amends the governing statute, ORS 419C, 610, to provide that a person who is adjudicated delinquent can petition the juvenile court to set aside the adjudication on essentially the same grounds and subject to the same limitations that apply when a person invokes post-conviction relief provisions in a criminal case. So basically this harmonizes post-conviction proceedings rights in juvenile cases involving delinquency with those that currently apply in criminal law. In the original bill, persons who were over 18 would have been required to seek post-adjudication relief in circuit court using the criminal post-conviction relief statutes, but the Dash 1 amendments would have amended that to provide that all post-adjudication juvenile relief would have to be sought in juvenile court, since juvenile court retains jurisdiction to expunge records regardless of the age of the petitioner. And then the Dash 2 amendments, let's see, those are the ones that we, let's see, what would the, you, we have the date
Chairman's
before
committee,
us?
They add the two-year statute.
Two-year statute limitations. There we have it.
Would it be helpful, Representative Shetterly, to
bring Michael up?
Yeah, to bring up Mr. Livingston.
I think it'd be great.
Address the Dash 2 amendments.
Wasn't the Dash 2 at the time we dealt with this a conceptual
amendment?
It was a conceptual amendment. Right. So I think for the record it would be helpful, Mr. Livingston.
They were in writing. They were not verbal. They were in writing.
Right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the purpose for the Dash 2 amendments is this. When the age groups were separate, that is, when those over the age of 18 or no longer within the jurisdiction of the court under the original bill had to go to the circuit court, under the adult post-conviction proceedings, they would be subject to a two-year to this basic statute of limitations. When we brought those people back to the juvenile court in the Dash Ones, that statute of limitations didn't come with it. And so what this does, what the Dash Twos do, is basically preserve the statute of limitations that would have applied if they had proceeded in circuit court. And the two-year limitation applies only to those over 18 or no longer within the jurisdiction of the court. We didn't feel there was any need to apply a statute of limitations to persons under the age of 18
or still within the jurisdiction of the court, because the court has, the juvenile court has continuing and original jurisdiction in those cases in any event.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what this does is it keeps what the original bill had with respect to these over age 18 folks, but does it within the juvenile court system. And then the second part of the dash twos is simply to give those folks who are sort of on the cusp at the time of the effective date of the bill that 2-year period to file their petition so that they won't get caught at the effective date. Is that?
So it's sort of a savings clause.
Yes, Chair.
And that's section six?
Yes, that's correct.
Of the dash twos?
Okay, correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Sherley.
One thing I recall too now, the dash twos incorporate the dash one amendments.
Yes.
Did we adopt the dash one amendments? We did this all conceptually. Do we need?
I thought we had adopted the dash one and had discussions, but by adopting the dash two here, we'll be.
Okay, so appropriate motion would just be to adopt the dash two? Okay.
My notes indicate, if I might. My notes indicate that Mr. Representative Shetterly moved the dash one with a conceptual amendment to the full.
Okay, so those are the dash twos.
Right.
Then, in that case, I would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2355.
Representative Shetterly has moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 2355. Is there any discussion to his motion? Any further questions while you have Mr. Livingston at the table about this bill or about the dash two amendments? Thank you, Mr. Livingston. Any objection to Representative Shirley's motion? Hearing none, the dash twos are adopted.
Chair?
Representative Shirley.
I move House Bill 2355 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Shirley has moved House Bill 2355 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll?
Ackerman?
Aye.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Lowe?
Aye.
Greenville?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Walker?
Aye.
Wilson?
Aye.
Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2355 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, and I'm going to ask Representative Lowe if she should carry this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be delighted.
We'll now open a work session on House Bill 2646.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2646 is very straightforward. It makes it a Class C felony to assault a public safety officer. Currently, it is a Class A misdemeanor. Representative Krieger is a carrier in the bill. The bill does have a fiscal impact in excess of $50,000.
Representative Krieger.
Chair Williams, this bill was very well, committee members, discussed. We had no one to actually testify in opposition to it, that I recall. I believe someone from the District Attorney's Association spent a half an hour trying to justify why they do not prosecute these things as misdemeanors and had to do with dollars and times. We had people from the OSP, Oregon State Police, Corrections, Oregon Consul of Police Associations, Senator Menace, Representative Menace, and I believe one or two others, all testifying in favor. There are a few points. I don't know if you have any of the records that we had, but under the current law, assaulting a police officer is a Class A misdemeanor, punishable by a maximum of 1 year in prison and a fine of $5,000. Under House Bill 2646, assaulting a public safety officer would become a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum of 5 years in prison and up to a fine of $100,000. There's a couple of facts are kind of interesting, I thought, that currently a penalty for assaulting a bus driver or ambulance driver is a Class C felony greater than the penalty of assaulting a police officer. Also, under current law, assaulting a public safety officer with bodily fluids spitting on them is a Class C felony. So if a criminal is, for a criminal, it's a smaller penalty to hit that same officer than it would if he spit on him, which doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Some statistical information was given to us from Sergeant Curtis, Oregon State Police, indicating that between 1995 and 99, 2,902 reported incidents of assaults on police officers in Oregon. 342 of them were on Oregon State Police. 99, we had 590, 265 involved officers being injured, which I think is a substantial problem for the state. There was some information from Dave Cook, Director of Corrections. I want to read what he has here because I think it really shows that this bill could have a good positive effect on the thing we're trying to straighten out. The 69th Legislative Assembly enacted House Bill 2273, which increased the criminal penalties for intentionally or knowingly for pulling any dangerous substance at a staff member to the level of assault in the third degree to a Class C felony. This legislation has significantly reduced the incidence of assaults and dangerous substances. During the first 10 months of the year 1999, the department averaged 5.2 incidents of assault with bodily fluids and substances each month. During the year 2000, the number of incidents decreased to an average of 1.6 incidents per month. This is a 69% reduction in assault incidents involving dangerous substances. And I think you'd have a very similar reduction if these people knew that there was going to be a consequences. Now there is no consequence that's really actually being prosecuted. Mr. Taylor did indicate there was going to be a financial impact of $120,544 for 2001-2003 and 2003-05. That goes up to over $1 million. One thing that we did not get information on was that there was no information on the amount of savings that would be available to agencies from the reduction of injuries, insurance costs, and time lost. I think it's a good bill, and the people that are doing the work for us need to be protected and given some courtesy from this.
Thank you very much, Representative Krieger. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to let the committee know there is no prior referral to Ways and Means Committee on this bill.
And on that note, members of the committee, I'll let you know that it is the chair's intention, having spoken to Representative Westland and the speakers in the Majority Leader's office, as well as Senator Minnis on this bill, that it's the chair's intention to send this bill to the floor. Senator Minnis will then pick this bill up on the Senate side, have a hearing in the Senate, and then we'll refer the bill to Ways and Means from the Senate Judiciary Committee. So we'll be sending this bill directly to the floor today. Representative Lowe, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am concerned about the fiscal that we have and question its accuracy insofar as the point that Representative Krieger raised, but also the fact that quite often when C felonies are charged, instead of jail time under the A misdemeanor that they would have gotten, oftentimes they get probation and long-term supervision. And I am wondering whether that could be factored into the fiscal impacts, if there are statistics available on that. And further, there was one other fiscal thing. I am wondering if the fiscal presumes jail time for everybody who is charged and convicted of this. And I think that if you could factor in some details about what percentage of cases actually result in jail time with under such charges, that might also further reduce the fiscal impact. And since we have to count our pennies very carefully, I'd like to make sure the data we have is accurate.
No, some fair questions, Representative Lowe. This bill, under any circumstances, regardless of how much work we do on the fiscal, is going to have to go through the Ways and Means process. The question was just when it was going to go to the Ways and Means process, and the determination was made that that would happen from the Senate side. But I think you asked some fair questions, and I think it's a fair game for us, even as the policy committee, to look at some of these fiscals and try to divine for ourselves, based on how the data was put together, what the effects might be. We have the great luxury today of having Mr. Lemon sitting in the audience, who I suspect was involved in some part in working up this fiscal. Am I right about that, Phil?
Only tangential, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, we'll ask you tangential questions then, if you're willing to take them.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, members, Phil Lemon from the Criminal Justice Commission. The commission does not take positions on legislation, but does work to coordinate the executive and judicial department estimates and assumptions that drive the fiscal impact. And we try to set this all out so you have a clear idea of what assumptions we're making, what data we use. That all goes through the legislative fiscal office that reviews both the data and the assumptions and gets wrapped up into the fiscal impact statement that you get. To specifically respond to Representative Lowe's question and Representative Krieger's statements, we do the corrections-based impacts. Our work by statute does not include the time loss, injury savings that might accrue to agencies. So that, I think, is a specific question for the Department of Corrections, but that is not a part of the work that we're assigned to do. As opposed to the jail versus supervision, the current Assaulting a Public Safety Officer statute requires a 14-day mandatory minimum jail sentence. So anyone currently convicted of the A misdemeanor APSO must serve 14 days in jail. By moving this to a Class C felony and assuming that we're going to rank it on the sentencing guidelines as a Category 6, that 14-day mandatory minimum stays in place. It is increased because the presumptive sentence, the typical sentence that should be imposed in the typical case, is 30 days jail up front. And so that's an additional 14 days in jail, or 16 days in jail that person is going to serve. In addition, because you're making it a felony, and I should say that that jail cost is up to the counties. The state does not reimburse counties for a jail term that is imposed as a condition of probation. The state pays for the entire length of felony probation. So, again, if these people are going to be a Category 6, that puts them on 3 years probation that is a state-paid cost. And so that will be that's because of the substantial numbers of people coming in on APSOs and a three-year probation sentence. That's a substantial cost to the state, and that's what drives some of this. As far as
could I just ask you, I noticed that in the, as I'm reading the effect on expenditures and trying to figure out sort of how the, do you have a copy of the fiscal?
Yes, I do.
The $71,000 in the 2001-2003 biennium that then jumps to a million, just slightly more than $1 million in 2003-2005. Can you explain to me, part of it obviously is this becomes effective into the, what, the last quarter of the biennium or the last half of the biennium? And then I assume that that increase in 2003-5 is as a result of these additional cases building on the probation side. Am I getting the impact right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Last session, the legislature said that any law is going to go into effect on January 1 of the year following. It used to be 90 days after session. So this has a little delayed effective date. And so anybody who commits the crime of assaulting a public safety officer on or after January 1 of 2002 then becomes subject to the C felony penalty. And then as those people get arrested, get prosecuted and convicted, we have what we call that phase in effect. But by the time you get into 2003-05 biennium, you're talking about the full crew of people and they're on supervision for 36 months. So it's going to take about 3 years before you get people dropping off that probation caseload.
Have you factored in the analysis? Because as I understand it, for example, one of the issues that the gentleman who was the assistant DA from Marion County, whose name I've forgotten, who testified on this.
Chief Dingell.
Yeah, Mr. Dingell, testified yesterday that, for example, one of Marion County's concerns is because they have all the institutional facilities or a large share of them in Marion County, it creates a disproportionate impact on Marion County having to handle these cases. But in looking at the fiscal, I couldn't tell whether or not you were assuming, for example, if someone's already in jail, they're already under supervision, they commit this act, and they are then sentenced as a result of it. Is there going to be, other than the handling of the court case and the trial for the crime, beyond that, what's the additional cost associated with a person who's already currently incarcerated?
Well, two responses. One is the the cases coming out of state institutions, state correctional facilities, are very small. Department of Corrections estimates they now have 2 cases a month that currently are not prosecuted under misdemeanor APSO that would be if it goes to a felony. So you're talking about 2 cases a month from DOC institutions. Those people are already in state correctional facilities. The effect of this bill on those people would, is that rather than not prosecuting them because all you can get is an additional jail sentence when they're done with their state prison sentence, you're now going to be able to get a state prison sentence tacked on to their existing sentence. But in terms of the numbers and how that works in the fiscal, that's not a substantial element. The most of these reported cases are from law enforcement, assaults on law enforcement officers, police officers. The LEDS data that we looked at and the contacts that we made with local district attorneys, most of those come in kind of 3 categories. One is responding to disturbance calls, whether they're domestic disturbance calls or other reports of disturbances. The second is in traffic stops and attempts to elude a police officer in a vehicle. And the third is in the course of making an arrest. And the subcommittee heard testimony about the distinction between a resisting arrest and what an intentional assault on a public safety officer is. It's those police officer assaults that form the majority of these cases. And so that's really, if you're looking at what drives the fiscal, it is the substantial number of injury assaults that are caused by people that do not use a weapon. We're assuming that any weapon assaults on a police officer or anybody kind of covered under APSO already is prosecuted as a felony. But it's the hands, fists, and feet assaults on police officers that is the large bulk of these cases, and that's what really drives the fiscal.
Representative Krieger has a question, and then Representative Rigo.
Chairman Williams, Mr. Lemon, what was the number of assaults that you used as the basis to get this $1 million expense? And then the other question would be, did they factor in the reduction that they might see? How did they do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the number we used is based on court data that shows current charges and cases where APSO is involved. There's, for the last 2 years, we've been pretty steady at about 330 people being charged with APSO. Of those, 90 have a felony that is more serious than the current APSO, and so that leaves 240 per year that are currently APSO is the most serious charge and then would become the most serious charge if it's moved to a felony. So those are the numbers we used as kind of the initial starting point. We then contacted district attorneys because one of the discussions that you had was how many cases, if we move it to a felony, how many are going to be treated as felonies, both for charging and prosecution and conviction purposes. Our assumption in our estimate was that 75% of the current misdemeanor cases would translate into felony convictions. And from the contacts that we had with district attorneys, I didn't get any information back that would lead me to change that assumption. You heard testimony from Mr. Dingell that if you make this a felony, they are going to feel obligated and get some pressure from the law enforcement community to actually follow through with that and treat these as felony cases and get those felony sentences. So that's the numbers we used and how we see this kind of moving through the system. Does that answer your question?
What I was kind of getting at, trying to get at the second part of what I was asking, is that they showed that when this type of rule was instituted on the feces and that type of thing, bodily fluids, they saw a 69% reduction. I think when it becomes public knowledge that this isn't acceptable and there's the penalty to pay, you are going to see a reduction. So if you use the full number, I think you've overestimated it by maybe 50%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, for the prison assaults, we did assume that those would drop in half. That was pretty much the consensus with the Department of Corrections and with the prosecutors we talk about, that once you start prosecuting these in-custody cases, that they will decline substantially. Again, most of these cases occur in the context of traffic stops, domestic disturbances, and making arrests. The DAs that we talked to said that the majority of these cases involve people who are under the influence of one thing or another. They didn't see a real prospect for a lot of deterrence just by making this a felony. And so absent that kind of testimony or information or consensus, we did not include any specific overall deterrent effect just by making this a felony.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Rigo.
Well, thank you. That is what I wanted to address. your analysis, and maybe you're just echoing the DA's, is that this is different than, say, an incarcerated person committing an assault, because when an incarcerated person does, A, they don't have a lot to lose, and B, they're not likely on drugs or alcohol, so a deterrent effect would be less likely to apply to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ringo.
I mean, more likely to apply to them.
We think there will be a greater likelihood of a deterrent effect for in-custody APSOs rather than the majority of them, which occur with police officers on the street.
Okay, and you see the majority of these take place when the offender is using drug or alcohol.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ringo, yes, that's what we heard from DAs, is that many of these, for example, on traffic stops, you know, you're after somebody for a DUI, or they're eluding and they're already on something and they don't have. The question on deterrence is really how much of a cost-benefit analysis does this person go through before they take a swing at an officer or do whatever it is they're going to do. And that's always the difficulty in trying to estimate that. But from we call the DAs and the counties that already are actively pursuing these cases, and the information we got back from them was we don't expect much of a deterrent effect on these law enforcement cases.
Thank you.
Representative Loeb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I have a general committee to those people who practice in this area and who are quite familiar with the sentencing guidelines. But what latitude do we have to tinker with a penalty if we reduce it from a Category 6 back to 14 days, but still keep it as a C felony, and change the sentencing presumption? There would still remain for the court the option of zapping them big time with fines and so forth, and that would seriously reduce the fiscal impact, but still give the public safety officers what they need in terms of leverage. Do we have that latitude?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, yes. The reason we assume the Category 6 is that this is my third session doing crime bill fiscal impacts. Every time the legislature has elevated something from that is currently an A misdemeanor and made it a felony assault, and there's been four or five instances of doing that, what the commission does is goes through an administrative process. We get a group of practitioners together and talk about what the similar crimes are and where it ought to go on the crime seriousness scale. Every time we've engaged in that exercise, either we rank it as a 6 or the legislature comes back and tells us to rank it as a 6. And so I learn slowly, but I do learn, and so I assume that because you're making this assault and you're moving into an assault 3, assault 3s are ranked at a 6, everything else we've been told to rank at a 6, so I would put it as a 6 for the purpose of this assumption. We don't have to do that. If you rank it at a lower level, you will have a lower presumptive jail sentence, you will have a shorter term of supervision, you will eliminate, in most cases, the possibility of a prison sentence resulting from this, and so that would affect the fiscal impact. And so that certainly can be done, but from history, we did not do it that way.
Follow up. I imagine that we're all going to have to do something a little different given the tight budget this time. But so what category would accomplish my suggestion, Category 2?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, yes. If we did that as a Category 2, what that would do would, the 14-day jail sentence, the mandatory minimum that's currently in statute, would be the highest penalty right now. In unusual cases where there was a substantial, where there's a departure warranted, a judge would be able to impose an 1145 sentence, which is technically a prison sentence, but it would be 12 months or less, so that time would be served in a local institution, a local jail or other facility.
So there you go. What it would really be doing would be to give the judge some discretion in these cases.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, judges would have discretion in these cases regardless of what the ranking is.
Yes, I know, but
except that
be more
when you rank it as a Category 2, you cannot impose a state prison sentence because the maximum departure would be 12 months.
I appreciate your answer. And so basically, if we do, as the legislative bodies say, that it's a Category 2, there wouldn't be a fiscal impact?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, it would be a lesser fiscal impact. You are still moving these 240 people, we're assuming, from a misdemeanor probation sentence, which the state does not pay for at all, onto an 18-month state-paid probation sentence.
So that was like take it in half.
Not in the initial, Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, not in the initial years. What you're going to do is out in the next biennium, people will go off felony probation supervision at 18 months instead of 36 months.
Representative Sherrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill, of course, doesn't direct the classification, and I think my point is just to clarify this to the extent that we're making legislative history here, that I think from the testimony that we received yesterday in the comments of the committee, the purpose of this is not just to create a Class C felony that would be treated the same as a conviction under current law. The purpose is to enhance the penalty, and so I think an increase in the classification to a 6, if that's, in fact, as you described the 6, I think that basically describes what the focus of the committee was yesterday in testimony in wanting to enhance the seriousness of this crime in terms of the consequences that would befall a perpetrator. So I just want that in the record, that if we're talking classification, which again is not in the bill, that there certainly was, I think, a strong sense of the committee yesterday to not only change the classification, but also make sure that the consequences are increased commensurately with that.
Thank you, Representative Shirley. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is exactly the place to say this, but I've got about a 5-year career as a patrol deputy in Josephine County as a reserve. Certainly not the kind of career that Representative Krieger has had. But I want to give a couple of observations about why this bill is in front of us and why it's something that we need to consider. And that is that few of us in the course of our jobs have to realize every day when you go to work that you may have to kill somebody or you may get killed yourself. And I always remember, I'm a radio announcer, that's what I do, but as a patrol deputy for 5 years, I had to think, this is really a unique situation. I go and make people happy from 6 to 10 o'clock every morning, and then when it's time to go on patrol on Friday nights, I put this gun belt on, and I roll the cylinder out and make sure all my rounds are in it, and I've practiced over and over in my head what I may have to do with that. And I always remember, and I'm sorry I get a little emotional about this, but I had a couple of friends one time on the force who attempted to take a steel worker into custody. And when I drive by that house, even yet today, I still think of the fight that Mac and Jack got into with this guy. And they went out to arrest him, and this guy literally beat these guys to a pulp, destroyed Mac's knee, and broke Jack's shoulder. But yet they managed to get the guy in custody. But I guess the tragedy of it all is that Mac never recovered. He never recovered. He couldn't be a deputy anymore, and it had a huge effect on his life. It had a terrible effect on his life, and he never recovered from that. When I stop and think about the nature of the job itself, and that is the fact that every day when you go to work, you know that you may have to do one of those two things I mentioned at the beginning. Most of us don't face that. And there are people in every community that are notorious for wanting to fight with the cops. So when you pull in behind them and you have probable cause to pull them over, either for an arrest, a warrant that you've got, or you've got, they've done a driving violation of some kind, you bail out of that car and advance on that car knowing that in all likelihood you're going to get in a terrible fight. And you can't just pull out your weapon and end it just to protect yourself. You've got to actually engage in physical combat with that individual. And like one of our people who testified the other day made the statement that a road deputy told her as a jailer that it was her job to get whooped up on. And that's really true. That's really true. You can't take it out on them. You've got to be a punching bag for these people. And what's frustrating, I guess, is you have the physical means on your belt to end it just like that. But you can't do that. You've got to go out and physically grapple and risk everything that you have to risk to take that individual into custody. So I'm sorry for the long ramble here, but as someone with a not too stellar but somewhat lengthy career as a patrol deputy reserve, we have to go back to the reason for this bill, and the reason for this bill is to stop people from messing with the cops in situations like this, because there are people who are absolutely devoted to doing that every time they see the overheads go on. And so, again, I implore you to remember what this bill is about and what it will do. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Krieger.
Chair Williams, just maybe a little information from the years that I spent. I went, you know, I was in rural Oregon. We had no radio contact for many years. They had radios that were Motorola. As you get 20 feet down the road, you couldn't get anybody. You were out there alone. Working in the Fish and Wildlife Division, I probably encountered 1,000-fold more people than the average police officer does that are armed. And it was not uncommon for those guys to have a six-pack of beer, and they're out shooting grave diggers. They're out at 2 o'clock in the morning. And you see them running a light. Maybe the shots have been heard. And you make those contacts in very, very rural settings. You don't choose always the time and place. There's no backup in rural Oregon. Even today, it's as bad as it was then, because we've lost all the deputies and road troops with the OSP. I was very fortunate on all those years that I was able to avoid a situation that would have put me in real bad jeopardy. Many of those contacts, you felt like someone was waiting for the opportunity. If you're well trained, you can head a lot of that off. But there are individuals who you will stop, as Representative Wilson has said, that they are, in fact, looking for that opportunity to assault someone. And it's not because it's me or with that officer. It's anyone of authority. And I think these type of people, I really believe that this bill does give some protection to police officers and corrections people. I think it will have an effect when it becomes known that this isn't acceptable and that, well, you go to jail when you do this. Right now, that's not happening. I think we need to support those people that are protecting us.
Thank you, Representative Krieger. Any other discussion? Representative Ringo.
Well, I have the greatest respect for the service that's been offered by Representative Krieger and Representative Wilson, by the many, many other police officers and public safety officers. And I certainly acknowledge the difficulty of the job. And I suppose that based on their impact and testimony, I'll probably vote for the bill, although I do want to note the testimony that I heard, that is, there's not going to be, there not likely is to be any deterrent effect. And if there was a deterrent effect that would prevent those sorts of assaults from police officers, then I guess I would more enthusiastically support this. I am mindful of the sentence creep that we have, though, and I just want to kind of state that whenever we seem to see a problem in society, the answer is to enhance the sentences with the hope that it will deter it, but without a lot of evidence it will deter it. And the evidence that we heard today, I didn't hear the evidence yesterday, was that the vast majority of these offenders are intoxicated or on drugs and are not likely to be deterred by sentencing. And I just want to say that I am cautious about continually supporting sentencing creep. And I will vote for this out of respect of the testimony that I heard, or the statements that I heard from Representatives Krieger and Wilson.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my proposals about modifying the categories under which these individuals might be sentenced, I in no way wished to minimize or marginalize the danger that our public safety officers face. In fact, I do support this bill. I want this bill to pass, but I want it to be a fiscal win-win for us. I would like very much to have our cake and eat it too. I fear, though, that if we send it to Ways and Means, however it arrives there, whatever process, that a fiscal of this magnitude will kill the bill, and I don't want this bill to be killed.
I appreciate that comment. One of the reasons that I intend to move this bill to the floor and then allow Senator Minnis the opportunity to work with the bill is he is, A, one of the chief co-sponsors, and, B, I want to give him the opportunity to have some time to consider what, if any, changes might be made to the bill to improve its chances of success before it gets referred to the pit of despair in the Ways and Means Committee. So that's essentially the reason that I think we ought to move the bill forward today and allow that opportunity to continue, and to allow our colleagues, many of whom serve on the Ways and Means Committee, to be able to partake and share in some of the same discussion that I think we had in committee today that I think will provide some benefit and some context. First, Representative Vicki Walker, and then Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the procedure we're taking here. Normally, a bill from this committee would go directly to Ways and Means, and you're asking it to go to the floor and then go across to the Senate. I'm just concerned that we need to convince all the other members on the floor that this bill should be passed over with a fiscal like this, because I'm not sure the fiscal has been resolved.
Well, as I said, Representative Walker, this is not an action I would take without having first spoken to the chair of the Ways and Means Committee on the House side, and also with the sponsors of the bill, and also with leadership, with the Speaker's office on the bill. So what I can tell you is this bill won't leave the body without going to Ways and Means. It's just a matter of timing, and I want to give the Policy Committee. Senator Minnis's committee on the Senate side an opportunity to have this same discussion there before the bill gets referred to Ways and Means. And that's the reason we're going to do it this way.
And if I might respond to that, given the fact that Senator Minnis is one of the sponsors of the bill, I would give him that courtesy, and I would encourage the carrier of the bill on the floor to let other members of the body know what the intent is and why we're doing it that
way. Right, and I think that's appropriate. Representative Shetterly.
Well, just a remark for the record. It's not unheard of to move a bill over from one house to another before it goes to Ways and Means. So I don't think we're breaking any new ground here. I don't have any discomfort with that. If we wanted to help ensure passage of this, we could amend it to provide that it'd be a felony to kill this bill. Give Ways and Means some impetus to fund it.
I'd be worried about what the fiscal impact of that might be.
Probably nothing, because he won't have to put up with the city water.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, with that, the chair would move House Bill 2646 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you call the roll?
Ackerman?
Aye.
Backlund?
Aye.
Wells?
Aye.
Greenbelt?
Aye.
Shetterly?
Aye.
Cheryl
Walker?
Aye.
Vicki Walker?
Aye.
Walton?
Aye.
Greenberg?
Aye.
Cheryl
Williams? Both aye. House Bill 2646 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Krieger, I'd like you to carry this bill on the floor.
Okay.
And we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 74.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 74 comes to you from the Court Administrator's Office. It allows grand jury to receive a court employee's affidavit into evidence when the grand jury is investigating a charge of failure to appear. Allows the court to send notice to DMV to suspend a person's driver's license for failing to appear on a traffic violation citation without rescheduling the trial on the citation. No amendments to the bill, no fiscal impact. And this may be the first bill to go to the governor's desk.
Is that possible?
No, we've had a bill, a revenue bill.
Oh, okay.
Senate revenue bill.
Yeah. Okay.
But who knows? It could be languishing someplace. You never know what comes out of that committee.
So far, not much.
Hey.
I'm sorry. Excuse me, Representative Shetterly. I was being flip again.
Representative Krieger, you're the carrier of the full on this bill. Do you have anything to add?
Well, not much, other than you mentioned this morning that Brad Swank was the only witness that was testified for it. And reading it real quick, it's not a whole lot you can say. It's straightforward. I think it saves time, makes a smoother process other than that.
don't have any.
I'm sort of surprised not to see Mr. Swank here today, but I imagine Ann is following the bill for him today. So, are there any further discussions or questions about this bill?
I do have one comment.
Okay, Representative Lowe.
You know, since these are going to proceed by affidavit, I think this is the one where you can, a clerk of the court or some employee could appear in front of the grand jury by way of affidavit instead of personally.
On a failure to appear.
Right, on an FTA. There's going to be some cost savings that will accrue to the state and the general budget by virtue of the fact that there's not going to be time loss for that servant, that public servant, as they're taking time off to go to grand jury. And I'm wondering why we don't have fiscal impacts that go in the other direction, positive ones, for these labor-saving and administrative savings-type bills. Just a thought.
Yeah, I think it's a fair question, Council.
Chair, members of the committee, the fiscal impact says indeterminate savings, and this may be a situation where it now frees a person up to do something else, so they have plenty of work to do. It's just a question that they're doing something else, so there really is not a per se dollar savings. It just means they can move on to something that's more efficient.
Thank you. I agree with that. But as a matter of public policy, don't you think the public would like to know that we are saving some money and making every effort to be as efficient as we can? I would like to start seeing some efforts.
Representative Lowe, I think that the challenge might be, in this instance, indeterminate means I think they asked all the questions. And I've always assumed that indeterminate meant that they weren't able to figure out that there was a complete FTE they were going to be able to save as a result of a bill. Seems to me like you almost have to get to where you're saving a body before you can actually get a determinate fiscal impact. But I think your point is well made, and I guess we can ask those who regularly appear before us on such bills when we think we're providing them some administrative savings to try to be a little more specific, at least with this committee, as to what they think those savings might be and how they intend to use them. I'm confident that in our judicial department, they are, by all evidence I have, understaffed, overworked, and I'm fairly confident with the plan that they currently have in place that they have plenty for their people to do. And so I'm not as concerned about how they might use the savings that they might be able to notice off of this. But I think it's an excellent point that you make. Is there any other discussion? Chair would move Senate Bill 74 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of my motion? Okay, would you call the roll?
Aye.
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 Vice Chair Griffin?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Both aye. Senate Bill 74 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would anyone want to volunteer to carry this? Sure. Anybody feeling like they don't have enough bills to carry out of this committee? Representative Cheryl Walker will assign her this bill today then. Well, that concludes our bill agenda. You'll notice at the bottom of your agenda we have an opportunity to hear today from Mr. Jeff Tryons, the Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board. He has a short presentation for us, committee, and I'd encourage all the members to stay. And I think you'll find this data fairly helpful from an overview standpoint as we consider some of the comprehensive issues we have to examine as a committee. So welcome, Jeff, and we'll turn the program over to you.
Hey, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. We'll just take a minute for my machine to warm up here and get... You should all have a hard copy of my slides. There we go.
I never thought of that.
For the record, my name is Jeff Tryons. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Progress Board. I know there are a few new members on the committee, so I'd just like to give you just the shortest of introductions about what the Progress Board is and what it is we do, and then we'll get right into the information. The Progress Board is a statutorily created organization within state government which oversees the maintenance and implementation of what we call Oregon Shines, Oregon Strategic Plan. That is a planning process that started in 1989. It was renewed and made a permanent part of state government in 1997. The governor chairs the Progress Board. There is statute. There is legislation in this time that would put a member from each from the House and the Senate on the Progress Board as regular members. There is some question, as you will see when the bill comes up, about whether members will be actual voting members or not. That has yet to be resolved. But the Progress Board hardly ever votes anyway, since it's a consensus group, so it's not really a huge issue either way. But we want the membership, we want the involvement from the legislature. What makes Oregon unusual, and I'm pleased to tell you that I went with the governor on Monday through Wednesday on his visit with the new president of Mexico. And Mexico, because I spoke in Guanajuato, where President Fox was the governor in 1998, has adopted our system for their national government in terms of using benchmarks for their high-level measures of success. The Oregon benchmarks are, no exaggeration, world famous, and the reason is because they're about results and not efforts. It's not about how hard we try, but it's about what we as Oregonians are actually accomplishing. The other thing that's important to understand is the benchmarks are for all Oregonians. This is not just a plan for state government. This is a vision for all of Oregon. That's why the Progress Board is made up of a whole set of leaders within the state, not public officials from state government. So it's a little complicated, but it works because it is for all of Oregon and not only state government. So we measure things like literacy rates, crime rates, air and water quality. We don't look at the expenditure side, the enforcement side of an issue. We're more interested in what we're actually accomplishing. Each of the benchmarks has a certain set of qualities, if you will. One is it has to be a clearly stated measure of something that links in with the Oregon Shines, with the vision. The example here is Oregon's national rank in the number of new companies Oregon as a whole, not state government, Oregon as a whole, creates in any year. So we've got to have the measure, we've got to have the data. You will find if you get into this for any length of time, there'll be lots of things that folks want to measure that we just don't have the numbers on. We believe that if we're going to have a benchmark and it's worth having the data for. And the other thing that makes Oregon unusual is that we set targets for where we want to be in the future for almost all of the benchmarks. The only ones the board has not chosen to set is for the level of Oregon taxation. The board has not set any target for how highly or lightly taxed Oregonians should be, but in every other area almost there is a specific target for where we want to be in the year 2000. We had one, we now have one for 2005, and we have one for 2010. Our new report will be on your desk, which analyzes all the benchmarks and looks at all the trends, probably in about 2.5 weeks. We involve lots of Oregonians in this process. That's the key to our success. We have 9,000 Oregonians who we could identify who over the years that we have existed have provided input into the process about where we want to be and where we want to and how we will measure how we're doing. So let me just review the data for you. These are the benchmarks that I chose that I think are most relevant to what you're doing with your work. We'll look at overall crime. We'll look at the arrest rate for juveniles. That's actually the wrong word there. You all know we don't know what crime, when it happens, whether an adult's involved or whether a young person is involved. We'll look at students who carry weapons in school. We'll look at the recidivism rate. We'll look at agreements that the state police have been working on to get a cooperative agreement for every one of Oregon's counties. We'll look at emergency management, and then one other area which you also have responsibility in is the percentage of child support enforcement that occurs within Oregon. So let's just look at the data, what's been happening. If any of you have followed this, you will know that Oregon's crime rate per 1,000 Oregonians went up dramatically during the early 1990s, and between 1997 and 1999, it dropped dramatically. So we are significantly lower than where we started in 1990 with the overall rate of crime. We're under where the 1990 level for the first time in a long time in 1999. We don't have the numbers yet for last year. We're under the target. One of the things the Progress Board does is issue a letter grade for every one of the benchmarks. So in this instance, we will receive an A. Last time we issued the grades, we received an F. So we've seen dramatic change in overall crime in Oregon. I would temper that a bit by looking at how we rank nationally. One of the things that's very important when you look at indicators is not only the trend for the indicator, but how you compare with something else. So this is Oregon and Washington's rank, and I'm sorry, when I looked at the slides this morning, I saw that the numbers for Washington are not readable, so if you want them, you'll need to write them in on your if you can even read them on the slide that's on the screen. Oregon has ranked higher than Washington, 1995, 96, 97. We went a bit lower than Washington in 98, and we're significantly lower than Washington in 1999 for index crimes. Now, index crimes are not all crimes. This is the ones that the FBI tracks because they're reported the same way in every state. So this is the only national comparator that we have. Index crimes are made up of person crimes, what we would call here, and property crimes. So violent crime is the person crime, and then everything from larceny to some kind of aggravated theft would be in the property crimes. Now, this is Oregon being ranked 45th of the 50 states. Oregon being ranked 41st of the 50 states doesn't really ring terribly right when I look at the numbers, because I traveled a lot of states and I know that the violent crime reporting, at least in Oregon, is a lot less than you would see in a lot of other states. When you look under this number, you will see that Oregon is about 20th, that is the 20th from the best in terms of violent crime. So we're really not nearly as bad as we look here for the violent crime, forcible rapes, murders, aggravated assault, but we're about 44th in terms of property crimes. And even with that ranking, we're the highest in the sort of the lowest area. In other words, larceny is the area where Oregon really falls down with this ranking. If we could solve our larceny arrest problems, our national ranking would improve dramatically. So I just wanted you to have the caveats there, but anybody looking at national numbers, if you were, say, looking to locate a firm and you were worried about crime rates in states and you just looked at the gross number, Oregon would not look very good in spite of the fact that we've improved our crime rate pretty significantly since 1997. We've moved closer to the national average in the last year, in the last reported year. You can see from this slide, Oregon is the white, went down, as I said. U.S. went up a little bit. So for a while, Oregon was going against the trend because the U.S. was going down while Oregon was still increasing. Now the U.S. went up a bit and Oregon was still headed in the right way. So we've made a lot of progress in the last couple of years any way you look at it, and the real sore point for overall crime is the larceny issue. Looking at arrest rates for juveniles, we see a very similar pattern. We see a significant drop in that since 1996. This is all arrests. This is for both what we would call serious crimes and less serious crimes as well. We didn't quite achieve the target that we'd set out for ourselves, which is to get back to where we were in 1990. So we haven't done quite as well on the arrest rate for juvies as we have for overall crime. We see a similar pattern when we look at how we compare with Washington and how we compare with the U.S. We're a little under Washington. Almost all of our high rankings in this area, once again, come from the least serious crimes. Behavioral crimes is where Oregon sticks out like a sore thumb from other states in terms of the arrests that we make. So, but even with that, we're headed towards the U.S. average, and the U.S. average is headed towards us. So know that we've got pretty high rankings in these areas, but they're luckily not in murder and rapes, but in things that are, well, there are states that are the number one murder states. I mean, we thank goodness Oregon is not, you know, does not have that kind of thing to struggle with. We've also seen significant improvement in the percentage of students who report that they have carried a weapon in school. That went from almost 20% of kids in 1995 and 97 to about 13.5%, I guess that's about 13% of kids in 1999. So we've seen an improvement there. Interestingly, we track what state agencies have primary responsibility for influencing benchmarks. And the last time we looked, we didn't have a single state agency that had as its responsibility to have an influence on students who have weapons in school. Another issue that you might want to look at on the policy side. One of the things that we track is recidivism. That is something that we should be able to have an impact on. This is the percentage of paroled offenders who are convicted of a new felony within 3 years. Now, we have split this out now. Next time I report, you will see we'll have one for adults, and then we'll have another one for young people. So we've added a new measure here, which will be one of the benchmarks, which will be the recidivism rate for juveniles. Here we saw a significant reduction in the early 1990s, and then essentially no improvement since about 1995. And we won't make the target that we had laid out for ourselves there. I would say to you that all of these targets are established with the advice of the agencies that are involved in whatever the measure is. So it's not like the progress board just goes out and grabs these. We get expert opinion, and we get agencies to come in and say, if we are ambitious but realistic, and that's the criteria that we use for setting targets, where should we be in 5 years? Where should we be in 10 years? One of the areas where we've had a lot of success, and the state police have really led on this, is to develop strategic cooperative agreements among all the counties for all the police operations within the counties. As of 1999, I believe we only had one county, and I don't know which one that is off the top of my head, that hadn't gotten one of these agreements in place, but we expect to have all the counties with all of those agreements in place, and then we'll probably be able to retire this benchmark and look at something else that's of higher need. Another area which a lot of state agencies are involved in is developing emergency response plans for all counties. We were once again right up around 100%. Actually, there must be more than one county. I have to apologize. There must be a couple of counties in that other one, because I know there's only one here, and we're up around 95%. So this will be expanded to include earthquake and tsunami-related emergencies, and when that happens, you'll see this measure will go down some, and then we'll have to work up again, because a lot of counties don't have emergency response plans for earthquake-related incidents. The other measure which is in your area is child support enforcement. When the legislature added staff in 93-94 to this activity, the amount of enforcement went up significantly. And this is a very staff-driven number. According to the department, they have had a constant staffing on this since 96. and their caseload has increased, so the fact that we've been able to keep it at the level that we have has been an improvement in their efficiency. Oregon ranks 18th here. We are the 18th highest ranked state for the percentage of child support enforcement orders that where we're actually able to go out and run down the money. Those are the facts. Now let's just look for a minute at how Oregonians view crime and other services that the public sector is involved in. The Progress Board, coordinating for about 11 state agencies, fields an Oregon population survey every 2 years. We phone 5,000 households. We hire a firm to do this. That's what they do. We get a lot of population information that many of our agencies use. We ask a subset of those folks how they view public services in Oregon. Is Oregon doing a good job, excellent job, fair job, or a poor job? Those are the choices they have. If they answer an excellent job or a good job, they get on this chart. This is in 2000 how Oregonians view public services, not just state government, but sort of all public services in Oregon. You will notice that community colleges is the top-ranked service in Oregon. It has been ever since we started fielding this, and right behind it is parks. In spite of all the problems that the parks have, Oregonians love their parks. You will see the crime is right down in the middle there where I have the red circle at about 75% of all Oregonians think that Oregon is doing a pretty good job at fighting crime. The bottom one, and the one that's been at the bottom ever since we started asking the question, is how well are we doing at helping to reduce the use of drugs? That is rock bottom. It's always rock bottom. And then the other one that I would just note for you is that if you look up here at all government, we see that almost 80% of Oregonians think that government generally is doing a pretty good job. That would surprise a lot of people. But that's a pretty steady number. This is changes between 1994 and 2000. You will see that by far the most improved public service as far as the public is concerned is our ability to fight crime between 1994 and last year. You'll notice for all government, it hasn't changed very much at all. It went down a little bit, but that's really within the margin of error. The second most improved is our ability to create jobs. In 1994, just for your information, most Oregonians still did not really believe that Oregon was out of its recession, in spite of the fact that the recession had been over for a number of years. Between 94 and 2000, Oregonians really developed a much more positive attitude generally about the economy.
And Jeff, can I just ask, when are these benchmarks going to be updated?
We will be releasing, well, you've got the new data that we will release. LEDS doesn't come out with their numbers for a while for crime, but our new report will be out in about 3 weeks.
I just am interested in, since sort of our more recent economic slowdown, of people's views about the creating jobs piece is going to change dramatically.
I'm sure that number, Mr. Chair, will go down some. We won't field the survey again until next year. We do it in even years. May of 2002. And then if you look at the change just between 1998 and last year, you'll see, interestingly, four-year colleges and universities got the biggest bump. Now, that may mean that people read the paper and they actually know that the legislature put more money into colleges and universities last time around. I can't really explain that specific increase, but you'll see that crime was the third largest increase between 1998 and last year. That's the end of my remarks, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions, get any comments that any of the members might have.
Appreciate you coming and sharing this information with us, Jeff. I always find this sort of thing fascinating to get a sense generally about how we're doing, both compared to our previous efforts and also compared to some of our neighboring states.
Mm-hmm.
Any particular questions? for Jeff about the data right now?
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and to the witness. I just need some familiarity with some of the terms you've used. On the index crimes that you mentioned, do those include drugs?
No, they do not. Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, index crimes are, I can read them to you if you just give me a minute to find the right, the index crimes are murder and non-negligent manslaughter, forcible rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, larceny, motor vehicle theft, and they will add arson at some point, but they don't have the data for that at this point.
I understand why we have the index crimes, because I understood your testimony to believe that, or understood your testimony to mean that this is a systematic way that you can compare from state to state based upon FBI data. But doesn't that really say that your results here are not statistically correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, they are statistically correct as far as they go, Representative. If you were to say how do states rate on serious crimes, then this would be a very useful tool. If you were interested on how states rated on use of drugs, people who illegally had a weapon, all those other crimes, which are much more policy sensitive. One of the reasons the FBI, I think, chooses not to use them is because those are ones where one state could say, we're going to arrest the heck out of drug users, and another state could say, we're going to focus on treatment. We're not going to arrest anybody. We're going to put them on another path. So those numbers would not be nearly as comparable as murder, because everybody gets arrested for murder. So it's they've gone as far down the road as they can go where they have comparable statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, it is accurate as far as it goes, but you get into policy sensitivity in terms of how much you want to enforce, you know, who you want to arrest and adjudicate, and who you don't.
Mm-hmm.
with the other crimes.
Representative Lowe has a question.
Actually, I don't have a question, but I do have a comment. Nice to see you again.
Very nice to see you, Representative.
I think that most Oregonians do not understand the function of the progress board or the benchmarks. It's not well defined for the ordinary, for the majority of the population. And the committee and anybody else who's listening, Mr. Tyrens does come out to communities and conduct town halls that help inform Oregonians about this. And I would say that it's a marvelous way to help drive policy for your district, to have community participation in this dialogue. I want to thank you for doing that, and I imagine that given the fact that the economy is going in the tank or seems to be headed in that direction, that you might find yourself out in the community quite a bit more to help shape the policy discussion that we must have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, I very much appreciate your comments, and I completely agree with you that making real change, being able to create the vision that we want for ourselves at Oregonians, has to happen at the community level. The state can sort of help to guide it, but if community people aren't engaged in these things and they're not sharing that vision and they're not working on it, it won't happen. I spent yesterday afternoon in Lane County with the Public Service Coordinating Council there, helping them with organizing their vision in a way that they can measure what they're accomplishing. And it's a lot of work, but that's where it has to happen.
Good. Well, thank you very much. Any other questions?
Thank you. Great.
I would just like to state a comment, if I might.
You may.
Mr. Tryons has been in my district presenting an Oregon Progress Board report, and he's just fabulous. And if none of you on this committee have had an opportunity to bring him into your district, I would encourage you to do so.
I just said that.
Oh,
great. Yeah, Kathy said the same thing, but we
let me say that I would encourage members.
I'm sorry, I was speaking to Representative Ringo at the time.
Well, it helps us to hear things again. I want to thank the committee as a whole this week. I think we probably, in the two subcommittees, took up at least 25 separate bills throughout the week. We were able to move five out to the full this week, and I know that we have a number that were discussed and worked on that we're waiting for amendments for next week. So it was a good week's progress for the committee, and I want to thank you, and we'll now adjourn.
We meet our Oregon Progress Board benchmarks for the committee.
That might-